33. Actually, that means we are expecting steady temperatures throughout the day today. It'll be windy with an east wind gusting as high as 40 miles per hour. An overnight low of 31. Then for tomorrow, cloudy, a high of 37. Continued windy, a southeast wind shifting to the west at 20 to 25 miles per hour. Then much colder on Friday, with a high of just 24 under mostly sunny skies. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll have the Wednesday morning show coming up for you in just a moment. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are going to be talking in the first part of today's morning show about a very important play that is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild. The play is called The Tin Woman. It's by Sean Grennan. And it is a story that touches on some very powerful themes of life and death and dealing with loss and dealing with sorrow and being kind and sensitive to one another as we make our way through sometimes really difficult pathways. And joining us in the studio is Doug Instanis, who is the director of the production and, of course, the managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild. We welcome you back.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. And via the telephone is Katie Gleason, who undertakes, in a sense, the title role of this particular play, which involves a woman who has had her life saved via a heart transplant, but who is dealing with all kinds of feelings of profound guilt. And that is guilt that she is only able to deal with by seeking out the family of the donor, the young man whose heart has enabled her to live. And Katie, as I said, is with us via the telephone to talk about her place in this cast. Katie Gleason, we welcome you as well to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for making time for this. Doug, this is a busy week, of course, with final rehearsals for what sounds like actually a more complicated production than one might guess. I mean, this is obviously very much a human drama, probably in some ways kind of an intimate story, and maybe not one that we would immediately assume has a lot of technical bells and whistles, and yet from the sounds of it, it does. So I'm sure these last rehearsals are especially crucial and complicated.
Yeah, it actually is one of the more complicated shows, except for maybe some major musical with 20 set changes and 30 mics going on. You wouldn't think that because it's a small cast of people, and we've had such a wonderful time at rehearsal, and it's been very flexible, and then all of a sudden we add lots of lights and projections and sound and kind of a stylized set, so the technical elements are actually another actor in the play, because there's some flashback scenes. It's really a heightened realism, so it's very artistic and interesting, and just not a bunch of people sitting at a table crying about stuff. So I think people are going to find it very interesting, very theatrical, very different than many of the things that we do at the Theater Guild.
And fortunately, the Theater Guild is a performance space in which some of that kind of technical wizardry is possible.
Yeah, we're very lucky. We've got a wonderful space, and the audience is only 10 rows from the actors, so it's very intimate for such a big space, and like I said, lots of lights and sound, and you know, projections are the way of the world now. Everybody wants to do projections. You look at the Broadway shows and the touring shows, they're doing that. But I'll tell you what, give me a set any day. Projections are hard. And, oh, they're not hitting right. They don't fade right. Oh, they're too bright. They're too, you know, we're missing the mark here. Somebody's standing in front of it. So all of a sudden, all these things where you say, oh, well, this will be easy. We'll just throw up a few projections. It'll be easy. Well, it's not.
Wow. Katie Gleason, as one of the actors in this cast, tell us what it's like to be part of a show and part of a production that involves some of this technical wizardry. Does it make it easier? Does it make it harder? What has it been like for you?
Well, it's a totally new experience for me all around. I find it absolutely fascinating. I'm actually very intrigued by the technical aspect of things. I don't know very much about it, but I would love to learn. And I just love how it creates the atmosphere that we're acting in. It does a lot to make me get into character, to really feel what I'm feeling. It's very emotive. So that's what I appreciate the most about the technical aspects of this. It's just made everything just that much more real to me.
Very good. Doug Instanis, tell us a little bit about beyond my introductory remarks, a little bit about the essential story of this show, and maybe a quick word about its origins. I mean, if I understand you correctly, its world premiere happened a few years ago right here in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, in Dort County, they performed it, and I actually know the Pam Rayberg did the costume design. It's a person that I've known for 40-some years, so it was like, whoa, how about that? I know somebody. But yeah, it was done in Wisconsin, and it's kind of written that way. You know, they're a type of, every once in a while, there's a little Wisconsin phrase that comes in. Excuse me. But, you know, the plot is fairly simple. Joy is recovering from a heart transplant, and she goes home, and a friend comes to visit, and they talk about a lot of things about her recovery, and she makes the decision that she'd like to know a little bit about the donor's family, and then there's a little debate about, is that a good idea or a bad idea, why that should happen, but she goes through it, and she actually reaches out to the family. Then the family goes through the same thing. Should we respond back? One of the things that's fascinating about this play is we found out what was really true and what's not true, and this play is very true. We've had numerous conversations with heart donor families and recipients and the organization that puts them all together, and this is a very factual play. So that was very interesting to find out that, you know, life imitating art, that it was, you know, sometimes things are heightened and dramatized, but no, this is really true. So you know, you have to reach out. Both sides have to be willing to meet, and then they make the decision to meet, and then Katie's character Joy comes for dinner, and there's a lot of things that go on at dinner, a lot of things that are being dealt with. So you've got Joy dealing with the her life and the pressure of having to live a better life because she's been given this gift, and she's got a great monologue that she talks about. I know you want this to be someone special, but this is who I am. You know, I'm just an average person, and you know, you want them to save the world, right? They have your son's heart. And then the family has to deal with the fact that they're looking at someone who is living and their son has not. And the father deals with it with a lot of anger, and because things were said that out of anger that he wishes he could take back. The mom is dealing with certain things. The sister is dealing with certain things. And I, making this sound like this is some heavy, everybody's going to cry, but there's so much joy and fun. And Sammy is the kid's sister, and she's adorable and funny, and she's a preschool teacher, and she brings a lot of happiness to this. Darla, who is Joy's best friend, is kooky and interesting and fun. They have some wonderful flashbacks, which bring back wonderful memories. So it's not, you know, so sad as I make it sound. There's a lot of happiness and hope and feelings of great joy in the play. So everybody kind of comes together and learns from each other and learns to deal with things and moving forward. And the one of the theatrical things that happens in the play is Jack, who has passed on, is ever present. So he appears in flashback scenes, as well as listening and reacting to the action of the play. And again, this play is very theatrical with slides and lights and having, we call him Upstage Jack. So don't upstage everybody. Just sit there and be quiet. So nobody, you know, because an actor on stage wandering about has the potential of stealing focus for the play, but he doesn't. It's he's very supportive. And so there's a lot of information, a lot of emotion, and I think a lot of things that even if you haven't had somebody that has passed, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned about, you know, even the just the how to be a donor and what that is, and what one donor can do to save so many lives. You know, you think of it just as a kind of a one-on-one thing, but, you know, the skin and eye and kidney and heart and lung and all these tissue stuff, you know, one person can make a huge, huge difference in the lives of so many people. And if people go away with that, then we've done our job. You know, we've really done a great job. So anyway, it's a wonderful, heartwarming show that will shed a few tears, but it will make you laugh and it'll make you think.
Very good. Katie Gleason, tell us about your decision to audition for this show and what drew you to want to be a part of it.
Well, I heard about the Tin Woman on the evening that the shows for the season were announced. And just even looking at the imagery that was, you know, in print about it, I was like, that looks like something that I think I'm going to be interested in. And then, of course, when the little scene was acted out, it was Joy in the hospital, and then when we got the synopsis of the story, I just immediately felt that I had to be a part of it in some way. It speaks to me on a very, very personal level. My husband actually was twice listed for a heart transplant. Unfortunately, he passed before he was able to receive a transplant. He was eligible very temporarily for both a kidney and a heart transplant, but then due to complications after surgery for a left ventricular assist device, was too weak to undergo the two surgeries for the transplants, the double transplants. So, it, you know, Joy's character, the character that I play, just immediately spoke to me as, you know, somebody that goes through a lot of the same things that my husband went through. And it was a way for me to kind of, you know, understand her character better too, to know what my husband went through.
Mm-hmm. If I understand correctly, you, and I think this was an appropriate and wise choice on your part, it's not like at the auditions you kind of announced to everybody, the reason I'm auditioning for this is because of this real life connection that You were cast in this role, and only after the fact did, for instance, Doug and your castmates learn about this real-life connection that you had to this story, or at least to its subject matter. Can you just talk a moment about when it was that you ultimately did share this with others in the production, and what it felt like to tell this very personal and painful story from your own past?
Sure. You know, it is hard to open up. I'm not somebody who naturally opens up very easily anyway, but I think it was when we were doing a read-through of the script, and Doug, we were stopped on a line about Joy needing to take 50 pills per day, like the anti-rejection drugs and so on, and I think Doug remarked, whoa, is that accurate? And from my experience, yes, I remember going through the whole list of drugs that would have to be taken and the whole routine and how important they were and how if you missed something, this could happen. And I was like, yeah, that's accurate. And, you know, that just prompted a little bit more questioning, you know, like, well, how do you know that? And, you know, at that point, I shared with Doug and another castmate who was there at the time, and later, I've shared it with a couple other people, and of course, I've been asked a few more questions about it now too. So, more of the story is out, but that's initially where I began to talk about it.
Hmm. So, if I may ask, what has it been like for you to be part of this production in terms of, in a sense, coming to terms with what you had experienced with your husband? Has been a part of this production been what you hoped it would be for you?
Yes, you know, everything and more. I mean, it's incredible to be part of something so like such a really, really good story with an incredible cast and crew. And you know, in terms of like my own personal grief process, it's done wonders for me there too, but I think that's also lent itself well to helping me become a better actor too. You know, I've learned a lot from Doug's direction and also the support of my castmates, and kind of bringing some of my own personal experience to my role. That has really, it's just been amazing.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Doug Instanist, the director of the production of The Tin Woman by Sean Grennan, and Katie Gleason, who is portraying, in a sense, the title role, the woman who has received a heart transplant, saving her life, but leaving her with all kinds of issues and conflicting feelings with which to deal, including some feelings of guilt. And she seeks out the donor family in order to, in a sense, come to some reconciliation of her feelings of having been given such a gift, but maybe not feeling fully worthy of it. Doug, tell us more about the young man who is the donor, whose heart is ultimately donated, and what we learn about what he was like and how his family viewed him and how important that is to the story.
Yeah, that's part of the kind of a bittersweet discussion. They talk about him. And, of course, Jack is seen throughout the play. His sister remembers him being the jerk big brother, you know, they gave her noogies and teased her and threw away her toys and stuff, but also remembers how he defended her when there was a bully there. And there's a very touching story that Bella's, the person's character's name is Sammy, she has this really heartwarming speech about how she remembers him, and he was funny. And then we see flashbacks, and I think that's the beauty of this play. It's not just storytelling. We get to reenact that. So we see Jack you know, at the dinner table making jokes about, you know, he was on, you know, like Match.com trying to find a date and how awkward that was. And then we see him at the coffee shop And I don't want to give away why you see him at the coffee shop, because there is some intrigue about how these people interact and how they meet and things like that. But there's a number of flashback scenes. And then there's a heartbreaking flashback scene where you see an interaction with the dad about normal parenting stuff. You know, we all say things. You know, families say things out of love, and only, you know, people that you love can make you that angry, right? You know, other people make you angry, you don't really care. But when, you know, people that you love make you angry and you have a fight with them, sometimes, you know, things are said. And so there's a powerful, powerful scene between Kevin Holofka, who plays Hank, and Phil Evernitis, who plays Jack, in a flashback scene. So we get to learn quite a bit about him, and we like him, and we hear his story, and we hear a lot of things. You know, it's kind of like a funeral, right, where nobody tells you all the wonderful things about you until you're dead, and then they tell, oh, he was great, he did this, he did that. And so the audience really gets to know him and likes him, and I think that makes the loss even harder, right? You know, when you like somebody and you know good things about them and their potential, and then the fact that they've passed at an early age, I think it just makes it play more powerful.
Katie Gleason, as someone who has experienced some of this in your own life with your husband, how true does this story feel in terms of the way they describe the donor situation? I mean, not that ultimately you ended up experiencing that phase of it, sadly, as you pointed out, things never were able to get that far for your husband. But nevertheless, do you feel like this play deals with kind of the complications of this authentically?
Definitely. Very, very much so. I really wish that I had some way to have, like, connected with this show before even going through the process. You know, when my husband went through the process, and, you know, you have to have a support system with you. And, of course, as his wife, I'm the support system. And, you know, you get all the medical facts, you get the statistics, but you don't necessarily get the human story until when my husband was in the hospital. We had people come in who were donor families and people come in that were heart transplant recipients to talk about their experiences. But at that point, we're in crisis mode. We're not in a mental space to be able to listen. So I think what's incredible about the story is that now we have an audience that can learn about this in a very real, authentic way from a human perspective. And that is incredibly inspirational and motivational. I really, really hope that it does inspire some people to reconsider decisions about whether or not they feel they can be a donor, and also to maybe reduce the fear and some of the stigma that can be associated with the process. I know that for a lot of people facing organ donation situations, you know, they're waiting for a vital organ, it's really a little bit alienating. And, you know, most of your life is dictated by the, you know, keeping on that list, doing everything that you have to do so you remain eligible, and just knowing that nothing is guaranteed, that you could die, you will die if you don't get this. And I'm just hoping that this sort of story keeps getting told, and that we can create a community that's more supportive of people that are either donor families or that are waiting for a vital organ or tissue or whatever else that they may need.
Doug, do you want to add anything in terms of what you and the cast have kind of learned about the whole process of organ donation, because not only of the play, but from some of these guests who have actually come in and shared with you?
Yeah, it was extremely powerful coming off of you know, like Little Mermaid, where all we're doing is entertaining people, to have a donor family come and talk about the passing of her husband, and that the decision that she made to donate you know, many of his organs and tissue and things like that, and that she actually made contact with someone who had her husband's heart, and how that went, and how she had pictures, and it was interesting because she brought her fiancé with her. And, you know, and this is what this play is about, really. It's about moving on, dealing with it. Life goes on. And she, I think, you know, there's a lot of hurt feelings in the fact that the family has lost somebody. But she has really turned it into a positive thing about how her husband's death has saved so many people. And I think that was very inspirational to hear. And then, of course, we had a couple heart recipients that came, and a gentleman came up and shook my hand at the first read-through and said, "Thank you for doing this play. You're going to save lives."
Wow.
Well, nobody said that to me at Little Mermaid. You know, and I love Little Mermaid. It was great. We had a wonderful experience. But to have somebody come up and just say, by bringing up this issue, by promoting, you know, people to sign their donor cards and to people to understand that this is a joyous thing. It's not such a evil, awful science fiction thing. I mean, really, it is science fiction, isn't it? I mean, there's a line in the play, "This is just a miracle." I mean, that you can just the and then we had the agency that combines all of this. Just how to the organization behind it, from signing your donor card to being on the list, to meeting with your doctors and going through these protocols and being 2 hours away from a hospital, and then someone is on life support, and then those doctors have to come in, and then the family has to give permission, and all the things that they struggled to get permission, and then they, you know, have to transport everything and get them to you in a certain period of time. I mean, it is just a miracle.
Right. And you're not even talking about the actual medical procedure.
Surgery.
Right.
And there's a few people that can do that.
Right.
You know, there's certain doctors that specialize in that. And it's just, you know, getting a heart from, you know, New York to Chicago and getting the person there and prepped and ready to go on a timeline. And just that is mind-boggling, not to even to deal with the grief and the human factor, just the procedure alone. So we've learned so much about this, and it is really you know, life-changing to hear these people's stories. This one gentleman thought he was gone twice, and you know, he had a pacemaker, and every time the buzzer went off, he thought, that was it. Here he goes. And you know, Joy has what's your line, Joy? "I was good to go." How does that, what are those lines? How does that go?
Yeah, I was good to go. You know, I do think that when people are faced with, you know, you're up against the odds. I mean, you just, that whole process of getting a transplant is just, it sounds impossible. So you almost have to make peace with death. You know, I was good to go.
In other words, I was ready to.
Yeah,
I made my peace. Yeah, and then someone says, "Here you go. You got another chance at life." Anyway, we've learned a lot, and we're feeling really good about ourselves. You know, that we get to do something that means so much to people, and that I think people will really learn a lot. I think they will be moved. And again, if we get a couple people to sign up to be donors that weren't, we feel like we did our job.
Hmm. Katie, anything else you want to add before we tell people about tickets? Anything you want to add about this play or the experience of being part of it?
I thank you to everybody who has listened to this story and that will come to see the show. I do think it will save lives, not only from a donation perspective, but also just mental health perspective. I think that it will do a lot for people to understand how there is hope, there is forgiveness, there's a lot of us that are sharing similar experiences, and that goes a long way.
So the Tin Woman is performed this weekend and the following weekend?
Three weekends
and all. And for people wanting ticket information, what do they do?
You should call the box office at 262-633-1250. You can order tickets online at www.racinetheater.org. Or the box office, when there's not a snowstorm, will be open from 12 to 6 Monday through Friday. So lots of ways you can buy tickets at the Racine Theater Guild.
And we hope a lot of people will seek out the opportunity to experience this show in person. Doug Instanis and Katie Gleason, thank you both for being part of the morning show today here on WGTD. It was great to speak with you.
Thank you, Greg.
And here's part two of today's program. For the next few minutes on the morning show, I'm going to be speaking with Roanne Weissman, who is a co-author of a book called Own Your Health, Choosing the Best from Alternative and Conventional Medicine, Experts to Guide You, Research to Inform You, Stories to Inspire You. Roanne Weissman's own personal story is a very interesting one, and we're going to talk about her own health problems and the way in which it helped her to look at the whole medical field in kind of a different way and helped inspire her to find a different approach to taking care of her own health. And it may be of great interest to some of you. Roanne Weissman, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Pleasure to be here.
I'm not sure that there's anything more potentially devastating than a stroke. And that is what you experienced several years ago. Tell us in the wake of that, how it helped you to see the medical world in kind of a different way.
Well, I woke up from surgery in 1995 with the left side of my body paralyzed by a stroke that was actually caused by the surgery itself. Obviously, all strokes are unexpected, but this was... I didn't expect this at all. I was 43 years old with two young children. I had been a medical journalist for many years. And suddenly the left side of my body didn't work, couldn't use it at all. And I realized after conventional stroke rehabilitation treatment, which is what people do, occupational and physical therapy, I had a couple of months of that. I began to improve somewhat. But I was still quite disabled. But at the end of that time, I got a call from the insurance company doctor, who had never met me, saying that in their view, I had plateaued, which meant that I was not going to improve any further, and it was now time to adapt to my disabilities. And adapting means, I learned, that you use devices. You buy shoes with Velcro. You learn to adapt to the limitations that you have. You buy special devices to fasten buttonholes to hold down a tomato so you can slice it. In long walks through the airport or shopping malls, they advised me to use a wheelchair. To me, that didn't make any sense. And I realized we all come to the realization, I think, when devastating physical injury or illness happens, that we're alone in our bodies. And in fact, everyone I interviewed for this book, whether they were recovering from cancer or heart surgery or injury or dealing with chronic pain, which is a huge health problem in this country, or chronic illness, or even menopause, or just the problems of growing older, everybody came to realize, who the people I spoke to, that we're alone in our bodies. And in fact, if we don't take some control over what happens to us, we can't really expect to get better often. And we can't really turn our bodies over to doctors, insurance companies, as if they were broken cars and have them be fixed. It just doesn't work that way. And in fact, research that we quote in our book says that people who feel some sense of control over their illness, over their bodies, actually do better physically and clinically than people who feel that like they are the helpless victims of their illness.
So what you experienced yourself and what you really advocate for others is something which you like to call integrative medicine, the idea that one should maybe think in terms not only of conventional medicine, if we want to call it that, but certain alternatives that might also be useful to the patient. It sounds like you do not necessarily endorse a wholesale rejection of one or the other, but you feel that there is an important place for both.
Absolutely. And in fact, the term integrative medicine came into was coming into wider use. It came about at the end of the the end of the last century, really. People started doing research on alternative and complementary therapies and realizing that, and many conventional physicians realized that they needed additional tools in their medical toolbox to help their patients. And in fact, often conventional medicine doesn't have all the answers. It can certainly save lives, and surgery and advanced techniques of treatment for cancer are things that we wouldn't want to reject ever. But why not add to these tools with other medical traditions that are some of which are thousands of years old and have been used by people of many countries and many cultures for many years to help illness? Why not have the best of all worlds?
Let's talk for a moment about some of the criticism lodged against conventional medicine or the way that conventional medical doctors do their work, because I think it's an interesting distinction which you draw. At one point in the book, you talk about how the most critical comments which you heard from the many patients whom you interviewed for this book, those criticisms tended to be leveled not so much at a given person's primary care physician, maybe a family care practitioner or whatever, but these kind of criticisms and concern seem more to be leveled towards specialists and surgeons who would step into the process at a point when a problem has arisen. And that seems to be where the most serious concerns are raised, correct?
Yes, and in fact, I had that experience myself. I'll just tell you a little vignette. I had heart surgery, which is what resulted in the stroke, the byproduct of the heart surgery. My surgeon is world-renowned for his work in replacing heart valves, which is what I needed to have done. I had a defective heart valve. And after, I had only met him right before the surgery, and then after the surgery, he came into my room, and after he'd been told I had a stroke, and said, "Oh, sorry you stroked, but heart-wise, you're fine." Meaning he had done his job, and he was satisfied. And I had stroked, that really interesting use of the verb. It had nothing to do with him. He wasn't treating me as a whole person. He didn't realize the devastation that having a stroke would have on my life, or if he did, he wasn't about to address it.
You mentioned the fact that in the foreword, I think, of the book, medicine has fractured the person it aims to cure into parts, even infinitesimal parts, in its focus either on the germ that causes the disease, the system or organ of the body that has been attacked, or the gene that predisposes a person to be susceptible to that germ. Modern medicine has come to neglect the patient as a whole being with emotions. Again, what you're saying is that is most likely, if it occurs, to happen with a so-called specialist, that many family care physicians do have more of a holistic approach, but specialists, almost by definition, will probably not.
And I want to be clear that this is not a condemnation of all conventional doctors. There are certainly many who treat their patients humanely and holistically and as whole people with bodies and minds and spirits all together. But the people I spoke with described fairly common experiences with some of the specialists with whom they dealt. For example, we have a whole chapter on pain. And one of the pain patients, in desperation to find some treatment for this pain that had basically ruined her life, that no one could diagnose or treat, had gone to see a pain specialist who spent most of the time, this was a woman doctor, looking at her watch, being impatient, and not really listening to what this patient had to say. And the patient said, "I felt like I wanted to grab hold of the hem of her white robe to just keep her in the room with me, to make her look at me in the eye and understand what this had done to me." And patient after patient, no matter what they were dealing with, Crohn's disease, fibromyalgia, pain, had the same experience with many specialists. People didn't look them in the eye. People didn't see them as the whole people that they wanted to be seen as. It's not the way we want to be treated.
It's interesting because we have a couple different factors then at play here. One of them is a sort of person to person issue and the way we treat each other. But then we're also talking about something that's a little more specifically physical and medical and in the way we treat a person or treat a patient. It's kind of interesting dual use of the word.
And also, the patients, and I had this experience as well, experienced their specialists, their physicians, not being concerned about the effect of the illness on the family. So in my case, for example, my husband realized when he had been told I had a stroke, I might never walk again. I should tell you, by the way, I'm completely well. And I don't attribute this to only conventional medicine, but to all the alternative methods that I combined with conventional medicine. So there's a happy ending to the story for me. But my husband was out in the hallway before he knew whether I would ever walk again or be able to use my arm. And he allowed tears to well up in his eyes, not in my presence. He was always very supportive. But out in the hallway, he allowed tears to well up in his eyes. And one of the doctors, who didn't really know us very well, and this was, again, a woman doctor, came up to him and said, "Oh, no, you must be strong for her." And that's not the only story that happened that people told me about. Another patient had Crohn's disease, was living basically on the couch, couldn't move for about a year because of pain until she was finally found ways to be treated. And her husband was dealing with his full-time job, the care of the children, the care of her, worry about her. No doctor ever asked him how he was doing. And the first time a doctor did ask him, he burst into tears because no one had ever seemed to care before. To me, the family is one of the biggest sources of health that we have, the people around us who give us the support and the nurturing we need. It's free health care. Why wouldn't the medical system support that?
One of the points you've already made is the fact that when we talk about some of these alternative medicines, which one might want to integrate into one's own health scheme, you talk about these being ancient practices. Some people would look at that as evidence of their worth. Other people would look at that and say, I don't get myself around in the technology of 3,000 years ago, and I don't build my house with the technology of 3,000 years ago. Why should I take care of my body with the technology or beliefs of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago? How would you respond to that?
That's one of the most interesting formulations of that question I've ever heard, I have to tell you. The way I would respond to that, there are two ways. One is that our bodies have evolved over millions of years, and 100 years of electricity and technology and central heating don't really change our basic inherited ancient physiology that much. And in fact, our bodies and our spirits have many of the same needs and requirements that our ancestors had when they were roaming around in caves. Not that we want to do that again. But I think we should recognize our ancient physiological heritage. And many of the experts in this book, one in particular in the lifestyle chapter, addresses that in her practice in a very interesting way, which if there's time I can talk about later, based in European natural medicine. But the other interesting thing is that, for example, acupuncture, which is a traditional Chinese medical technique, probably 5,000 years old, maybe older, has always been used, I learned in my research, to treat stroke patients. And in fact, the sooner you can treat a stroke patient with acupuncture, the better the chance of recovery. I used acupuncture when I learned this in my own recovery, and it definitely helped. And now there's research going on. In our book, we have, for every topic, we have sections called What's the Evidence, which gives the latest research data for, it's not just a fluffy book. It has some real evidence and information for people. And in fact, there's research about acupuncture being done here in Boston, where I live, that shows it's in fact effective for stroke and spinal cord injury and paralysis and hemiplegia, which is the one half the body is not working because of stroke. There's actual research now that's backing up what was known, I think, thousands of years ago. And it's not just in acupuncture. It's in herbal medicine. It's in ancient Japanese and Chinese and techniques of body movement and energy work. Tai Chi, for example, the research shows that elderly people who use regular Tai Chi practice have fewer falls and fewer broken bones than people who just do regular aerobics or exercise. No one knows why that is, but it's significant that that's the case. Mm. Maybe it has to do with movement of qi, which is the Chinese form of energy within the body, balance, strength. Nobody really knows. But it's significant that these ancient methods are being borne out by the results of scientific research in modern times.
you touch on one fact, which, of course, we want to just talk about briefly, and that is the idea that many of these alternative medicines are predicated on this idea that there is some sort of life force or energy in the body, which you yourself in the book say is something that does not show up in any kind of X-ray or on any kind of blood test or whatever. And yet, for many people, it seems to have significance. And many of these alternative medicines seem to tap into that energy force, whatever you might call it or whatever you might think about it. Of course, it does bring to mind the fact that if we're talking about something as intangible as that, then, of course, it also means that it's possible just about anybody to put up a sign and pretend that they've come up with some new way to tap into this mysterious force. I think what your book is attempting to do is to try to concretize these long-standing practices, which over time, at least for many people, seem to have achieved some results. So we can help to discern what does seem to be genuinely helpful versus some of these other things which might not be.
That's true. And in fact, my co-author, Brian Berman, MD, is the director of complementary medicine at the University of Maryland. And he's known throughout the country and even throughout the world, where he lectures frequently, for his expertise in conducting major NIH-funded research studies on complementary and alternative methods to determine exactly what you're talking about, what works, what is safe, what is not safe, and how do we discern the claims of people from what actually happens to our bodies.
I want you to answer also a question about what you think is the value of the personal story. Because it's an interesting way to attack this. Your book is an interesting mix of research study results and that sort of thing, but mostly it is the stories of individual people and how they have come to better health through some of these methods. Tell us how you think that can be a helpful source of information for people.
Well, one of the many experts I interviewed close to 100 people for this book, so I've got many different perspectives. And one of the, he's a holistic psychiatrist whom I quote and use in the book on the chapter on trauma, said that we learn best by stories. That's how we really learn. Dry information and facts can be useful, but what really makes a difference in our lives is the story of someone who overcame a horrific health challenge or a terrifying diagnosis and survived. And if we get to know that person, one person who read the book told me that she knew personally the people in the book, and it really meant a lot to her. This is a doctor reading this who was reading it for information. But I love to tell stories. I'm a journalist. So what means the most to me is the personal story. And so we juxtapose the personal stories with expert advice on what people can do, garnered from many different experts in both integrative and conventional medicine, as well as researchers and alternative practitioners. And we also added in the evidence for the skeptics, everybody should be a skeptic and ask questions, for people who want to know more. And I've never seen a book like this, which is why I had to write it, because it's the book I wish someone had given me when I woke up with half my body paralyzed.
I remember you saying that you feel like you were at a loss because there was not a book like this on the shelf to help you try to put things together.
I've never seen one like it, before or since.
The chapters deal with various situations and conditions such as cancer or pain or aging well, women at midlife. You already mentioned the chapter called trauma. Very interesting.
We even have a chapter on childhood illnesses because I found, as a parent, I was interested in this myself, there are many treatments that can involve alternative methods to help children, for example, with ear infections and asthma. There's some very important research going on at the University of Arizona now about treating children with asthma by using biofeedback and also autogenic training. It's a form of self-hypnosis where even children can learn to visualize pathways opening, airways opening, and it has an effect on their lungs and, in fact, can reduce the need for steroids.
A very thought-provoking book, again, called Own Your Health, Choosing the Best from Alternative and Conventional Medicine, by Roanne Weissman, published by Health Communications Incorporated. Rowan Weissman, a real pleasure to speak with you today on thank the morning you. Show, and I thank you for writing this interesting and helpful book.
I hope it can be useful to people.
And it's 8:59 here on WGTD. Our weather forecast, we are under an ice storm warning in effect until noon tomorrow. We'll have a high today of 33 degrees, which is where we are right now. So steady temperatures are expected all day long. And very strong winds gusting as high as 40 miles per hour. Our overnight low, 31. Tomorrow, cloudy with a high of 37 degrees. Turning sharply colder, actually, on Friday, then temperatures should rebound a little later in the week. Again, we expect treacherous driving conditions through much of WGTD's listening area today. Stay safe. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical.